This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. What a splendid week for American democracy.
And just remember that when you go vote, it ain't gonna change a damn thing. Because all the laws that are already on the books are already bad enough, and all we're gonna do is make more laws that take more wealth and property and power from the people to themselves.
On Thursday, 13 right-wing alleged domestic terrorists were charged in a plot to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. This is from a TikTok video made by one of the men charged.
Because that's what it's all about, is taking your freedom and your money so that they can empower and enrich themselves. That's what criminals do, and that's what the government is. Peace.
Also on Thursday, Donald Trump demanded that Attorney General Bill Barr indict Joe Biden and Barack Obama. This week, Texas Governor Greg Abbott was sued over his October 1st executive order, limiting presidential ballot drop-off locations to one per county. The largest Texas county, Brewster, is bigger than Connecticut. On Monday, the Supreme Court overturned an appellate court and permitted South Carolina to require that absentee ballots be validated in writing by a witness. And, oh yeah, during Wednesday's presidential debate, a United States senator tweeted in opposition to democracy.
We're not a democracy. That was Utah Republican Mike Lee's first Twitter declaration. In the second, he elaborated, quote, "Democracy isn't the objective. Liberty, peace, and prosperity are. We want the human condition to flourish. Rank democracy can thwart that." So the question is, when, at least since the protracted, ferocious debates during our nation's infancy, did American democracy become a debatable proposition? When did our democratic system, not the implementation of it, but the very idea of it, come under blatant, explicit attack? We'll consider the current moment in a few minutes, but first, let's review another moment it came under furious fire, not all that long ago.
According to Nicole Hammer, research scholar at Columbia University and the author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics, conservatives first toyed with a republic, not a democracy slogan in the late 1930s.
The conservatives who were involved with the America First Committee, which was this committee founded in order to prevent the U.S. from getting involved in World War II, were somewhat affronted by Franklin Roosevelt saying that the U.S. needed to wage this war to defend democracy. And the way that they pushed back against that appeal was to say, well, wait a second, we're a republic, not a democracy. And so that's the first time you start to hear this as a kind of political slogan to fight back against rhetoric about American democracy.
Then again, in the early 60s, not only in the heart of the Cold War, but at a time when the Supreme Court was codifying the Bill of Rights into court decisions toward a more liberal democracy, the John Birch Society's founder, Robert Welch, declared this is a republic, not a democracy. Let's keep it that way. What was he up to?
Robert Welch was really opposed to the liberal Justice Earl Warren's Supreme Court, in large part because the Supreme Court had ruled in 1954 that schools could not be segregated. And then in the 1960s, what happens is the Warren Court begins to press for this idea of one person, one vote. And this was part of the same push that was going on in U.S. society for Black voting rights. And an opposition to both the principle of one person, one vote, and to the protection of Black voting rights was really driving the John Birch Society to oppose the expansion of voting rights, the sort of leveling of voting rights. And that was all contained in this slogan of a republic, not a democracy.
The John Birchers opposed some of the more famous decisions of the Warren Court. You mentioned Brown versus Board of Education, but there was also Reynolds v. Sims about the very question of one person, one vote. What were the details of that decision and what effect did it have on the nature of American democracy?
So you had state legislatures where districts were determined by geography, by things like counties, which led to a more Senate-like form of representation where very small population counties had the same political power as very large population counties. And the Supreme Court intervened and said, you know what, that's not fair, that's not representative, and ordered that state legislatures decide their districting on the basis of population. It was a really important moment of putting some oomph behind this idea of one person, one vote.
I can remember when the John Birch Society was regarded as a kind of lunatic fringe of reactionary thought. Now its positions are more or less mainstream conservatism. What was its solution at the time for an activist court?
So their first solution was to impeach Chief Justice Earl Warren. That was the big rallying cry on the right in the early 1960s. But then it became part of a broader conservative project to get more conservative justices on the Supreme Court. Now, that was clearly a much longer term project, but that's kind of where you see the seeds of a new focus on the Supreme Court as something that could be a protector of conservative political power and ideas.
Now, the debate you are talking about seems to happen at a time when conservatism finds itself on the wrong side of the political consensus in the country. So what happened in the early 80s amid Reaganism, in which the conservatives very much represented the consensus of American wishes and thought?
Conservatives could look around during the 1980s and say, no, wait a second. It actually turns out that direct democracy and majoritarian elections, that's working out pretty well for us. So there is this moment during the 1980s at the height of the Cold War when Reagan is talking about democracy and when conservatives seem to be winning these landslide elections with the majority of the population behind them, that, democracy has a bit of a moment in conservative circles.
The U.S. Senate and the presidency are representatives of a political minority, beneficiaries of the structurally disproportionate electoral representation as a percentage of the population. Is Lee agitating for nothing more than the perverse status quo?
I think that there is a real fear among conservatives that even the kind of minoritarian benefits that are already built into the system through the Electoral College, through the Senate, are at risk.
Nicole, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Nicole Hemmer is a research scholar at Columbia University and author of Messengers of the Right, Conservative Media and the Transformation of American Politics.